The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, special edition, April 3rd. The Washington Post reports this evening, Mueller told Trump's attorneys the president remains under investigation but is not currently a criminal target. According to the Washington Post, in private negotiations in early March about a possible presidential interview, Mueller described Trump as a subject of his investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election. The special counsel also told Trump's lawyers that he is preparing a report about the president's actions while in office and potential obstruction of justice. The report came the same day as Alexander Van der Zwaan became the first person sentenced in the Mueller probe. Joining me on a recorded conference line, apologies for the lousy audio quality this evening, are Paul Rosenzweig, Orrin Kerr, and Quinta Jurassic, each with special things to talk about the latest turns of events. Let's start with Quinta, who was in the courtroom today when Alex Van der Zwaan sang his Van der Zwaan song. Sorry about that, guys. Quinta, what happened? What was the scene?
Yeah, so it was pretty anticlimactic for the first sentencing in the Mueller investigation. The stakes were pretty low. So Van der Zwaan pleaded guilty to one count of 18 U.S.C. 1001 for lying to Mueller's investigators. He concealed information regarding his contacts with Rick Gates, who's also been indicted by Mueller, and an unnamed person A, who the press has reported to have been Russian intelligence officer Konstantin Kolomnik. So the maximum sentence was only 6 months. And Judge Amy Berman Jackson ended up sentencing him to 30 days in jail and a $20,000 fine. That sounds pretty light in the grand scheme of things, but Judge Jackson did emphasize that she did consider sentencing him to time in jail to be serious, and she wanted to emphasize the gravity of his decision to lie, not only in and of itself, but because Van der Zwaan is an attorney and because he was lying in the course of an incredibly important investigation.
Was there any indication that he had either been cooperating or not been cooperating with the investigation? Is there an indication at this point as to whether he's an important figure in all of this or a kind of bystander who lied to the FBI and so they indicted him or prosecuted him?
So from what is in the public record, it seems more likely that it's the latter, that he's more of a sort of bystander who stumbled into this. So based on the publicly available court documents, there's actually no mention of a cooperation agreement in his plea agreement, which is a difference from the other individuals who have been indicted over the course of the Mueller probe. And there was no mention of cooperation by either Van der Zwaan's defense or by the special counsel's team headed by Andrew Weissman. The general suggestion seemed to basically be that the extent of Van der Zwaan's conduct was what he pleaded to, and that there may not have been anything more, that this interaction with Rick Gates really may have been the extent of his involvement in the Russia investigation.
So at the end of the day, is this the last we're going to hear of Alexander Van der Zwaan? I mean, it sounds like that's probably it, right? He's pled guilty. He's been sentenced. The judge takes it seriously. The FBI takes it seriously. But it despite his weird connections to lots of people, it may not be more than that. Is that what you're saying?
So that is my guess based on today's hearing. But look, I mean, as Mueller has reminded us, we don't know what we don't know. I wouldn't write off the possibility of something just dropping out of the sky that teaches that there's a lot more going on here. Based on what we have in front of us, it seems like it's more likely that Alex Benderswan serves his time and vanishes.
All right. So let's turn then from there to the situation that isn't going to vanish, which is the larger investigation. Oren, Paul, you have both been federal prosecutors. Let's start with the question, how much should we read into the idea that the president has been notified that he is a subject but not a target?
This is Oren. I think not very much for a couple of reasons. One is that it's not clear that the president of the United States can be a target, because target generally means somebody who's likely to be charged criminally, and it's not clear that criminal charges can be brought against a sitting president. It seems unlikely that Mueller was going to ever contemplate that in the first place. And then second, you know, if he's not a target now, he could become one after the interview if he says something that is fishy, which seems pretty likely. I thought the most important takeaway from the story was that Mueller is trying to figure out if Trump had a corrupt intent, that he wants to interview Trump in order to figure out Trump's own mental state. And that means really getting into what Trump was thinking. And so that's ordinarily something that would make you say, wow, he's the target, right? Or he's somebody who in a colloquial sense would be the target. This is not a story of Mueller isn't interested in Trump. This is a story of Mueller is really interested in Trump. It's just he's not planning on bringing criminal charges against Trump now, which we never thought he would anyway. So I think that target subject distinction is just kind of meaningless in this context.
You agree, Paul?
There's in traditional parlance, there's a third category, which is a witness.
He's not a witness.
Yeah. Well, that's right. That's what you want to be, because that's the person who's walking along the street and sees the accident. And when they call you to interview you, you say, am I just a witness to this? They say, yes. And you say, okay, great. I'll come on in and I'll talk to you and tell you everything I saw. So being a subject is somebody who's, as Oren says, who's conduct is within the scope of the investigation and is potentially subject to criminal charges. I'm on record as saying that I don't think that Mueller will indict, because I think he thinks he's bound by DOJ policy. But, you know, being the subject of a criminal investigation is not a comfortable thing either.
So let's, for those listeners who don't understand the distinction between a subject and a target, let's break it down. My understanding, and I have not reviewed the U.S. Attorney's Manual this evening on this point, but my memory of it is that a subject is a person whose conduct is at issue in the investigation. A target is somebody who you have decided you mean to bring a case against as a prosecutor. And that generally speaking, prosecutors will, this is not in the U.S. Attorney's Manual, but I do think it's pretty standard practice, keep people as subjects as long as they can, consistent with their own consciousnesses and the facts and their own intentions. Because the moment you identify somebody as a target, at least in a white-collar investigation, you have to notify them. You know, that will trigger an entirely different relationship with that individual. Is that a fair summary of this?
I think that's a fair summary. You're correct in saying that there is an internal DOJ policy against willy-nilly calling targets for testimony, either before the grand jury or for interviews. And there's a strong policy in favor of notifying them of that status before doing so. So in some ways, the fact that Mueller is saying that Trump is a subject is consistent with his wanting to interview Trump, because if he actually thought he had criminal evidence and that Trump was already a target as to whom an indictment would be brought, he'd have to notify him of same, and he probably would never get an interview with him, right?
Now, if you believe, as Oren started this by saying, if you believe that the president can't be indicted or that Mueller, even if he can be indicted, is likely to consider himself bound by the Justice Department's opinion that the president can't, it follows then that the president can't actually be a target at all, as Oren suggested. And so I'm wondering, in this case, is it a kind of semantic game to kind of reassure the president to get him to agree to an interview, that you say, don't worry, you're not, you know, we know this is a guy who got really angry at Comey for not saying he wasn't under investigation. So you kind of reassure him and say, look, you're not a target, you're a subject, leaving aside the small matter that as a definitional matter, you probably can't be a target. Oren, is that kind of gamesmanship part of what's going on here? Or is it just being a straight shooter and saying, hey, this is your status within the investigation?
We need to be in the room when they're having this negotiation to know how this information is coming out. I think based on the Post story, we don't have any evidence to draw a conclusion either way, at least that I can see. You can imagine just the president's lawyer saying, okay, tell us what our client's status is, and then they tell them, and that would obviously, you know, be information that the president's own lawyers are trying to get out. So I don't see any evidence of gamesmanship based on the Post story, but we just may not know based on what we have so far.
But there is one piece of evidence in the Post story, not of gamesmanship, but that it's having that effect, which is the description of the president's reaction, which is that he feels very vindicated. Ironically, the same guy who got really furious at Comey for not saying publicly that he wasn't under investigation now seems grateful to Mueller for saying that he is under investigation, just that he's not a target, right? But he feels vindicated by this, and apparently it makes him want to go in and have this interview. So, I mean, I'm curious for both of your senses of the president's reaction and the president's team's reaction, which it does seem to have really divided the lawyers. Paul, what do you make of it?
Well, like Oren, I think that this was probably in response to a direct question. It would, of course, be the very first question I would have as the president's lawyer when approached for an interview. What's my client's status? I can't really tell you about whether this is reassuring to the president, because honestly, I've given up trying to get inside his mind. What I can tell you is that I'm on the side that John Dowd is reported to have been on, which is to say that I have sufficient skepticism about the president's attention to detail and fidelity to the truth that I would lie down on the railroad tracks in front of the train to try and stop him from doing this. And so I kind of actually read it the other way, which is that if I were Dowd, I'd be saying, sir, you're the subject of an investigation. That means that you're in the zone of conduct. That means that they're thinking about you as a possible target. You cannot do this. You must not do this. That would be my take on this.
What do you think, Oren? How should we understand the president's reaction and the divisions among his legal team on it?
Well, you know, just based on public news reports, there's a theme that emerges of the president having the intelligence and maturity of about a six-year-old. And it may be that he's just not sharp enough to get these subtle distinctions that we're talking about. And he just hears you're not a target, and he fills in what that means to him. That's certainly the sense that I got from this particular story, that he just doesn't get it. And I share Paul's sense that if you're Trump's lawyer, you're trying to come up with a way to impress upon him that this is a very serious situation. And at least based on the story, it sounds like Trump just doesn't understand.
All right. So this brings us to what I think is the most interesting component of the story, which is actually that Mueller also conveyed that he was writing a report. The story reports actually that he's working on a staged set of reports, the first of which is on obstruction-related matters, and a later one of which would be about Russian interference and collusion-related matters. It is not clear from the story whether those reports are imagined to be reports to Rod Rosenstein under the reg that Mueller was appointed under, whether they are imagined to be reports to Congress for impeachment purposes, or whether they are imagined to be reports to the public, like an independent counsel final report, or like a, you know, like the statement that Jim Comey made at the close of the Hillary Clinton email matter. This follows a considerable little back and forth that we had on Lawfare that
Quinta and I, on the one hand, and Jack and Maddie McMahon, on the other hand,
had about what reports would and wouldn't be proper and under what circumstances for Mueller to file. It sounds like he's writing something. And so I guess, Paul, you've actually been involved in the writing of an independent counsel report to Congress. How did you read this aspect of the story in terms of what Mueller appears to be working on?
I don't think that we can figure out which of those three it is from the story. I mean, it's clear that this story is coming from somewhere inside Trump's camp. That's how we know all the details about Dowd versus Sekulow. And so I don't think they know. My assumption, my working assumption, would be that it's a report akin to what the regulations require him to give. That is a report to Rosenstein that Rod Rosenstein may then choose to make public or not as he sees fit. I have a working assumption that Rosenstein will make any report from Mueller public because of the public interest in knowing what it says. But I do not think that Mueller is going to go outside the bounds of the regulations and do anything more than what they permit and require him to do. That's kind of my view of it based upon what little I know of his character.
What did you make of it, Oren? When you read that, did that scream the Mueller report, it's coming, or did you read it as a more constrained report to Rod Rosenstein that it'll then be Rosenstein's decision what to do with?
I think Paul is right that we just can't tell. There is that one line in the story quoting a person familiar with the discussions that they've said they want a report on this to answer the public's questions, and they need the president's interview as the last step. So that suggests that there's some idea that this information will become public, but we just don't know how. You know, is it Rosenstein that ultimately makes it public or not? We just have no idea as to how that might happen. So I agree with Paul that we just can't really be sure.
Quinta, where did you read this as mapping on to our earlier discussions with Jack and Andrew Kent and Paul, earlier writing on actually special grand jury reports as an option here? When you read this, how did you see that discussion?
Well, the thing that I noticed was not actually Mueller's characterization, but I assume someone in the Trump camp who is quoted as saying that Mueller's team has, quote, said they want to write a report on this to answer the public's questions. Of course, that is a paraphrase of what I imagine Mueller has told this person who's probably in the White House. So we can't know if it's accurate. But if it is, it struck me as mapping on to, Ben, what you and I wrote about sort of the role of the special counsel as a truth reporting role, not only as someone who can deliver an impeachment referral, but someone who has an obligation to inform the public of what he's found. And as we laid out, there are a couple different models for how that might happen. As you say, it might go through the regulations, through Rosenstein. It might go through the grand jury. There are a couple options. It's obviously, as both Paul and Oren have said, not clear what specific route Mueller's team is thinking of, but I found it striking just to hear that they were preparing a report at all, just because we've spent so long being used to being in the dark about what the team is doing. And it's sort of tantalizing to have this option held out that we may one day know what's going on.
Yeah, so I want to throw out one additional reason to at least wonder if it is something more than just a report to Rod Rosenstein but something that is either meant to become public or meant to inform congressional discussion. And that is, look, we are getting this information. This is the Washington Post's gloss on the president's lawyer's gloss on Mueller's team's statements to them about what Mueller is thinking or and planning and what they're trying to do. So we have three levels of interpretation going on here, and there's a lot of room for error and miscommunication in that. But it does seem to me, with that caveat, it does seem significant that the purpose that Mueller communicated or that Mueller's team communicated to the president's lawyers what they're up to is not finishing up cases, not getting ready to issue indictments and close down the rest, but that the objective is the writing of a report. And that sounds to me very Ken Starr-like. Not, I don't mean that in the sense that some listeners will hear it in a pejorative sense, but Ken was very focused on the truth reporting function of the independent counsel, and he put great weight on the function of the report writing in that regard. And for the president's lawyers to come away from that interview request with a sense that the output is a report strikes me as a pretty significant data point in terms of what Mueller's people are actually doing. I'm curious, Paul, I have a feeling Paul viscerally disagrees with what I just said, but I'm curious whether you do.
I don't viscerally disagree. I do acknowledge that the reference to assuring the public of what has been found leans a bit in the direction that you and Quinta have been talking about. I'm just skeptical that that is an accurate depiction of what Mueller is intending. I mean, everything we've seen about this man so far is as buttoned down and internalized as any prosecutor I've ever observed, either from the inside or the outside. This is a man who hasn't made a single public statement that I know of since his appointment. So perhaps he's thinking that the deputy attorney general might wish to make this public. Perhaps the deputy attorney general has asked him to provide a report that would be suitable for public release, especially in the event that it determines that there's insufficient evidence of obstruction of justice to recommend charges, even were he able to bring such charges. That would be a very useful thing both for the deputy attorney general to have and for the president to have. But I can't see that as how Mueller is approaching this. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. We'll see, right? What do I know?
So there's one more interesting data point before we wrap up, which is this memo that the special counsel released yesterday evening in conjunction with a filing in the Manafort case that also, I think, does in this regard give some interesting background on his relationship with Rosenstein, which is, of course, fundamentally at issue in any discussion of a report. Paul, you mentioned before we started recording that this suggests to you that Rosenstein really has his back. Walk us through that.
Well, yes, I did think it was actually pretty significant, not for the substance, but for what it reveals about the nature of the interaction between Mueller and the department. The story, of course, is that Manafort moved to dismiss the indictment against him on the grounds that Mueller's investigation was too far afield and was not within the bounds of what he'd been assigned to do by Rosenstein. And in response, Mueller essentially pulled out of his back pocket a hole card, which was a memo that was written by the deputy attorney general, the acting attorney general, 7 months ago in August of 2017, explicitly authorizing the investigation of Manafort by Mueller, which, as far as Manafort motion is concerned, is probably going to be game, set, and match. But what it really reflected to me that was significant was the fact that, at least as of August 2017, Mueller and Rosenstein were in communication were coordinating the scope of Mueller's investigation, and that Mueller was seeking and receiving from Rosenstein affirmation that he was going down a path as authorized and permitted by the department itself. So Mueller's saying, am I doing the right thing here, boss? And Rosenstein is saying, yes, sir, you got it. Keep going. That's the direction you want to go in. And I approve of that. And that seems to me a pretty significant marker now revealed in public of the nature both of the ongoing coordination between the special counsel's office and the acting attorney general. And more importantly, that an expression of the confidence that at least as of that time, Rosenstein had Mueller's investigation and a willingness to give him the reins to go ahead and follow the Manafort money trail wherever it might lead, even if it's to Russia and the Ukraine. So I thought that was pretty significant. And, you know, the message for right now, of course, is that if that relationship remains the same today as it was portrayed in that memorandum, then it is unlikely that acting attorney general will respond favorably to pressure to dismiss Mr. Mueller, absent actual misconduct.
So let's wrap up with a quick look ahead. Oren, as you read everything that's been going on the past couple of weeks, including but not limited to the two matters we've talked about today, what are you looking for? What are you expecting? And what do you have your eyes on in the days ahead?
I think the biggest takeaway is that Mueller is really focusing on Trump and wants to get the testimony from Trump to say whether Trump had a corrupt intent to try to thwart the Russia investigation. Things are gathering speed and beginning to focus more on the president, contrary to how a lot of people are reading this latest story.
Quinta, what are you looking for?
So what I've been waiting for since Ty Cobb started on the president's team over the summer has been for Ty Cobb's strategy to stop working. Because Cobb's strategy has been to say, this investigation is going to wrap up. You're going to be fine. You're going to be exonerated. And it seemed to me that that's always been a ticking time bomb. So I think what's going to be interesting is to watch as we progress toward the point where this interview does or doesn't happen, to see whether or not Trump stays calm and under the obvious delusion that this investigation is going to go away, or whether he starts to realize that he's actually in serious trouble.
Paul, what are you looking for next couple weeks?
I'm actually looking for the subject matter to change. I think that the prospect of an interview about obstruction of justice for the president is actually, to the extent that this story is accurate, a signal that Mueller is pretty much ready to wrap it up. That unless the president blurts out in the middle of the interview, yeah, I was trying to do it because I hate the damn bastard, that Mueller has concluded that he can't prove the requisite intent, and he's ready to write a report to that effect. So I actually think it's going to flip the other way, that the next phase is going to be a return to the focus of where much of this investigation really is, which is on all the people around Trump during the campaign and the connections, if any, between that campaign and Russian activity. That's where I'm looking next.
Just to mix it up a little, I will say I continue to wait every day for the hacking indictment, which I still believe is coming, and with no evidence or reason other than inference to believe it's coming, but I do believe it and keep waiting for it. On that note, this has been a special edition of the Lawfare Podcast. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast, and some of you have been doing a fabulous job of it. Thank you for all those ratings and reviews we have been getting on Apple Podcasts. For those of you who haven't done that yet, time is running out before retribution will be exacted against you. But there's still time, and you should do that. Normally, at this time, I say that our music is performed by Sophia Yan, except that, you know, we don't have music on the special editions of the Lawfare Podcast. So I'll say it anyway. And of course, the Lawfare Podcast is produced, as always, in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.